welcome to Talking Beats with Daniel Lalchuk. That's me, and I'm so glad you're here. If you like what we do, I'd love it if you gave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you're so compelled, write a review. That really helps, and maybe tell a friend or family member. They might like the show as much as you do. If you want to get involved in the program, visit our website, talkingbeats.com, and click Support the Show, where you can make either a one-time or a recurring donation. As we look to continue having cliche-free conversations of real substance with a diverse range of the world's most compelling people, your support is so appreciated, especially as we look to expand and increase our offerings. If you have a question, comment, or thought, find us on social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, or if you wish to reach out directly, email me at daniel@talkingbeats.com. I'm so glad you're here. Let's get on with today's conversation. On today's program, we're speaking with singer-songwriter Noel Paul Stuckey. He's been a crucial part of the American music scene since the 1960s, when he became famous as one-third of the legendary folk trio Peter, Paul, and Mary. The group who helped define the sound and the style of American music from then up to now was a major part of Noel Stuckey's musical life. But as you'll hear, he's done a lot of other things. He sings, he writes songs, produces albums, and gives live concerts up to this day, now in his 9th decade. He remains a beloved musical figure with a devoted and passionate following. He says, quote, "I've been learning over the past 50, 60 years, come in contact with some really wonderful people at some really wonderful moments like the March on Washington. It awakened me. It awakened all of us. My particular form of expression has always been music, whether it's making up romantic songs in high school or bringing the mission of my heart to fruition." I'm thrilled to have an American musical legend with me right now, Noel Paul Stuckey. Welcome, sir.
Thank you so much. Been looking forward to this. It's rare, you know, in today's high-tech society just to do an audio interview or a conversation.
It's nice to do it without the video, I think, and I actually think you can get more out of it usually. Well, we'll see. Hopefully I'm not speaking too prematurely, but I don't know. There's something about just chatting like a good old-fashioned phone call that is really nice, and not worry about what's the background
Oh, yeah. Maybe in some ways that's a metaphor for folk music as opposed to the current state of pop music, insofar as it communicates directly, authentically, and without bells and whistles.
I saw a picture of you playing recently, just a guy on stage with a guitar, and I don't think you had backup bands. I don't think you had dancers and lights and pyrotechnics. It was all in the music. What's going on?
You know, carrying that a step further, I lamented about a couple of months ago, watching halftime at the Super Bowl and thinking to myself, "My gosh, what? I thought this was about football." And then it occurred to me, being a songwriter, that maybe I should write a song called "The Super Bowl," since that seems to be the construct for halftime entertainment now.
But what is folk music? You mentioned it before, and I think it's a term a lot of people are familiar with. You know, me, I'm from the symphonic world, but I try to be a fan and interested in all kinds of music. I certainly do love folk music, love your music, love other folk artists. But what is folk music to you?
Well, it's certainly a lot more broad than just one man, one guitar. I think the impact of folk music on popular music in the early 60s was creating an awareness for a radio listening public that the many local perspectives on life were expressed in different styles, but had a kind of, I don't know, a ring of day-to-day to them in terms of life and its challenges and its small victories. And so folk music to me is more about attitude and message than it is. As a matter of fact, I wrote a song called "Not That Kind of Music" that has a first verse that says, is not that kind of music, he said with a smile. It's more about the message and less about the style. And then he played a chord, and each of us would try to learn a part. He brought us all together, singing music from the heart. And it ended up being an homage to Pete Seeger. But just to continue the description of folk music one step further, I saw a delightful, and I think it's still there on YouTube, video of Arlo with Pete in Africa somewhere. And Pete's talking about folk music and how it's wonderful for everybody to sing together. And Arlo pipes in and says, yeah, you know, most people think you got to sing If I Had a Hammer or Blowing in the Wind or Where Have All the Flowers Gone to Be, you know, for it to be folk music. He said, but if the criterion is people singing together and feeling something together, he said, here's a song by Elvis Presley. And he started singing Fool's Rush. And 30,000 people in South Africa wow. sang it with him. So when you ask me what folk music is, I think it's a music that brings people together, sometimes because of the message, but sometimes because of the opportunity to confirm the message by singing together.
There was a CD album that you did a couple of years ago. You were in Maine. I guess you live in Maine, and this is the Maine tour, and I was just listening to it today. In the car, I'm in New Hampshire right now and sort of down the road from you. And I was listening to this guy with a guitar who gets the public, gets the audience to sing along with him. And it's it actually translates great over just the audio. You can sort of picture being there. I don't know if it was at a concert hall or what. But why do you want them to do that? Obviously, there is a tradition, Pete Seeger and others. There's a great tradition of getting them to sing with you, but what's it about for you? Why do you want to get them involved? Not just that they sit there and listen and clap and have a good time, but that they actually sing, no matter how they sound, they sing.
Well, you know, we could belabor the pursuit of artistry and confirm the fact that people spend many years honing their craft. And God forbid, you know, there would be a concert at Carnegie Hall where Heifetz plays and everybody pulls out a violin and accompanies him.
I think he might walk off the stage pretty quickly if that happened.
So I think to a certain extent, participation is always understood to be a convivial meeting, like a family reunion, in a sense. First of all, the message has to be, you know, understood or agreed upon, or why would you sing it at all? And second of all, your talent doesn't need to be honed to the kind of level that the leader has. You know, when we went to camp as kids, and we all sang, you know, sat around and sang, "She'll be coming around the mountain when she comes." We didn't have to sing with a professional quality. It was just the joy of joining together. So for me, not every song I sing is a sing-along. As a matter of fact, if I go to concerts where every song is a sing-along, I'll probably leave because I want some time to have a lyric that causes me to reflect rather than to participate. And so in my concerts, I generally try to balance that. But there is, you know, there's a value to interactivity, and audiences sometimes are shortchanged when all they can do is applaud. For instance, at a classical concert, when someone between one of the pieces makes a comment about an uncomfortable moment on stage, or maybe a microphone falls on a boom stand halfway down while they're performing. And they speak about the fact that they hope that the critic in the audience did not have a similar reaction to the tune. And the audience bursts out laughing. I think laughter is also, you know, a convivial interaction as strong as music is in reminding us of our commonality and our community.
Talking about the strength of music, you're in your say, seventh decade of making music. That's just a guess. It's probably true. Mm-hmm. I imagine you started as a young kid. You're not a young kid anymore. It's been with you through your whole life. To talk about how you got started, is it the sound that grabbed you? You know, for me, with the cello, it was just the pure visceral sound. And then, of course, when I discovered the repertoire, that sort of opened up a whole new world. But it wasn't that I wanted to play the Dvorak concerto when I was four, as I wanted to play the cello and feel and hear the sound. What was it with you? Was it voice or guitar that grabbed you?
I would have to say guitar, because it's the manipulation of the instrument that is a constant challenge. I've been blessed to have a voice that, as you've suggested, has borne me well for seven decades, eight decades, actually, being 83 now. I gave up smoking in 1971, which was a considerable length of time ago, and I certainly have not regretted it, because I think to a large extent that's contributed to the health of my vocal cords. What I'm really trying to say is that the vocal challenge doesn't really exist for me in a way that perhaps it might for a operatic singer or someone who has to sing on a daily basis without a microphone in front of a large group of people. You know, ever since the advent of microphones, our personal singing styles, I say our, those of the vocalist, have eased, the demands have eased a great deal. And the nuances that are available to someone singing quietly are captured so easily. So not much of a challenge vocally for me. However, the guitar, because I never had formal lessons, still, if I read sheet music, it's laborious. It's with a great deal of effort, and it really doesn't translate to my fingers very quickly. The upside of that is that it has caused me to strain, to understand, and to recreate those wonderful atonal moments caused by passing notes in a chord. I don't know if you've listened to Peter, Paul, and Mary tracks closely, but to a large extent, I was always the guy that was introducing the major seventh or the augmented or the diminished.
Do you have, can you explain to folks, or I don't know if you have it, not to be intrusive, if you have a guitar nearby, could you just maybe say or play what you mean by augmented and diminished and major seventh?
Sure. Probably the easiest one to hear is, and I don't even know if it's in tune. So here is an A. And here, by changing one string, one fret, is an A major seventh. Now, it's a subtle difference, but it has a different emotional quality to it. And in the beginning of the Peter, Paul, and Mary trio time together, I was often, because of my love of jazz chords and alternative chords, I was often in conflict with Peter, who was much more of a purist. And I remember him reaching over in the hallway one day and saying, "Noel, you can't play a major seventh on a Woody Guthrie tune." And I said, "Well, you can on some." He said, "But not this one. I think we were doing 'This Land Is Your Land.'" However, you know, Deportee, there are songs that have an emotional content to them that sometimes are saluted by playing alternate chords. So I've, over a long period of time, developed a repertoire of either music I've written myself or versions of music that incorporate color chords. Matter of fact, here, I don't know if I can pull this off, and if I can't, you can edit it out. Oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for a that if there's an emotional quality involved in a, particularly in a ballad, I think that we are to be encouraged in a sense to add colors that enhance the emotional response as well as the understanding of on a deeper level of what the song is trying to communicate.
What's it like to pick up the guitar, do a little singing, and you know, at your age versus at age 50 versus age 30, you know, what, I mean, you said the voice is in good shape, but what about the deep inside, you know, you have all this life experience, it all adds up. We've talked about before on here how Toscanini, the great conductor, said it's all there. Everything you read, every book you read, every conversation you have, every piece you play, it all comes out in the music somehow or another. You know, so you play, sing a simple phrase like you just did, but somehow different than it was a year ago or 30 years ago.
I think that's in the eye of the beholder. We can only bring to our music as performers who we are. And if that should have added depth from when you saw us or heard us in our 20s, 30s, or 40s, then I think that that's a measurement that we're not allowed to know about. I think that that's simply in the hearts of the listener.
You got so well known for being one third of the trio of Peter, Paul, and Mary. And, you know, it's no longer going, Mary's no longer live. Who knows if what would be happening now with the trio, but she's no longer around. The trio doesn't exist. Do you like talking about Peter, Paul, and Mary, or is it such another part of your past life that you want to move on?
It's nice that you put it in those terms, because I'm an evolutionary kind of guy. When the trio stopped touring in 1970, it was essentially because I wanted to get to know my family again. I had just gone through a pretty heavy spiritual experience, and it called me to recognize and to search for what the real value in life was. And it wasn't about success, which certainly, as you've mentioned, the trio had in abundance. It was more to be a successful father, and to be as honest and forthright in all of my life as I could be. And so to recall the early years of Peter, Paul, and Mary is kind of interesting and sobering at the same time. Parts of it were sad, some of the choices that I made, I regret now. But then when we got back together again after what we affectionately referred to as time off for good behavior in 1978, I think we brought a kind of a maturity to the creation of the songs, both in terms of our writing and in terms of our arrangements, and some knowledge from the solo years that we had spent apart. And so that grew and continued to grow into the capacity to express ourselves individually as well as a group. And don't you find it kind of curious, I do, that the name of the group that we ended up choosing, though we had, you know, the Willows was one of the titles that we might have gone with in the early 60s, we chose Peter, Paul, and Mary, which, my middle name notwithstanding, became a vehicle, a logical vehicle, really, for us to step onto stage for 10 minutes every concert night and do a solo piece, whether it was comedy or whether it was music. And that sort of created, I would say, a safeguarding balance for the personalities of the trio. We never felt that kind of, I'm not being understood, or no one recognizes me, or I'm just part of a group that's got a leader and a couple of hit tunes. We each claimed an identity that was our own and somewhat unique to the group. And so we brought that to the group when we were on stage. But in our solo lives, we have continued in those directions with much of the learning that came from working with the trio. And that learning extends not only into our personal performance preferences, which is to be perhaps a bit too chatty on stage, but affable, accessible, amenable, progressive, pointed, political. But it has held us in good stead in our private lives as well.
Were Peter, Paul, and Mary best friends off stage?
We were never enemies off stage. I think we were misunderstood. We misunderstood each other sometimes, what our goals and ambitions were. And sometimes we took umbrage with the positions that one of us might take on stage in a solo section, and then we would speak to it after the concert. But we were affectionate, but our lifestyles really did not suit a compatibility that got us together every night. I mean, basically, when the concert was over, we might give each other a hug. We might just say, see you tomorrow. We might say, see you in a couple of months if we had some time off towards the end. But we did not live in each other's back pockets. We definitely had separate lives and, you know, different spouses, different kids, different directions. And I think it was a healthy part of our relationship, actually. Kind of a, you know, democracy in action, if you will.
In terms of the solo writing, we have music and we have words. We have text. And this is the same with you and the same way it is in a Mozart opera. There's music and text, and they have to go together. Music, text for you. What's the relationship? What is building off what?
It's interesting you should bring that up at this particular time in my life, because as I review the credits for the music that I'm associated with, I'm looking at the normal division, which you just mentioned, which is music and lyrics. And recognizing, as I have for the past 30 years now, I have an increasing awareness over these past 30 years of a third element that's seldom mentioned, except maybe in an interview, but never credited in terms of sharing in the publishing or the writing monies. And that is the arena of the brilliant idea. Who proposed the concept? Now, if a singer-songwriter says, I want to write a song about an anti-nuke song, and he writes Nukes or Nuts, which was on that album that you were talking about playing, he might borrow he might get a line from a friend of his, or he might get a chord change from a band. And to the extent that he's upfront and connected with his bandmates or his writer friend, he'll include their name in the credits. But who gave him the idea to write the anti-nuke? Was it his? Well, if it was, then the two divisions, the two normal divisions of dividing up the music of the monies that come in for the song seem logical. But lately, I've been aware that some people just come up with great ideas and they mention it to you in a cocktail party. And if you don't let it go, then they really are a participant as well. So most of the songs that I've done or been working on lately, I make sure that the person who came up with the idea gets credited as well.
Well, does it really happen at a cocktail party? Someone comes up to you, they say, I mean, does that actually happen?
Oh, yeah.
What would they say?
Sure.
It seems a little presumptuous, no, to come up to you and say, you know,
No, it doesn't happen like that. They don't come up and say, hey, why don't you write a song about, although that does happen, but that seldom is the writer who gave you the idea. No, this happens when you're standing in a crowd and somebody says, oh, you can't get there from here. And you go, what? I mean, of course, they probably said it in a Maine accent. Oh, you can't get that from here, dear. And you're not going to do it in the accent, but you're stuck with this concept. You can't get there from here. What does that mean? And how does that apply to the current political situation we find ourselves in, or the impasse between the far right and the far left? What What is the musical bridge? What is the, and I don't mean that just musically, I mean, what is the conceptual bridge that you can build between these two ideologies? So if that were the case, if that were to be the case, and I saw this person again in another party, I'd say, you know, that idea, that phrase the other day that you said, you can't get there from here, I'm turning that into a song. And then inevitably, I mean, they'll be kind of blown away or say, oh wow, really? Well, the only reason I said that was, and then they'll give me another line that may end up as a lyric in the song. So if you're open and sensitive, you know, in a way, I lament the fact that the classical training has, to a large extent, with the, you know, visible exception of Yo-Yo Ma, created a bank of musicians who are loyal to the page and less than accessible and open to inspiration on a day-to-day or a note-to-note basis. Inevitably, during recording sessions with classical musicians, Peter, Mary, and I, we would sing maybe a part that had occurred to us that would be very nice on a particular song. And the person would have to write it down because they did not play by ear. They did not learn by ear. And in many instances, they wouldn't write it down. They'd be, you know, I thought you wanted a cello player. You know, I'm not a composer. I'm not an arranger. So
It's tough. I know what you mean. In a way, I wish every classical player would just be forced to just write a little music now and again, even if no one else heard it other than themselves. I think it would be a great exercise to just say, yes. You know, just play yes, around and even not write something down, just sort of improvise something, a little tune, and even if it was terrible, at least it's not coming straight off the page. I know what you mean. I was put in a situation recently. I was at a place and there were lots of amazing musicians around, none of whom were classical, and I had my usual solo Bach and a few other things, and they said, you know, we really want to do this blues tune, and you're here, so would you play? And it took some arm twisting and a few other things, but I did, and certainly got past the initial trepidation, because there is trepidation. You want it written down. You want to know exactly what to do. Is that louder or softer, or is that in above middle C or the one below, or you know, how do you want that chord voice? And sort of got beyond that. I said, Dan, just you got to get past this man, or else the song's going to be really long. And I did it. It was wonderful, and they were all shocked, and I was shocked. But it takes a little doing.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, the downside of not knowing how to read music is that some 50 years later, in the recall of all of these quote, fabulous color chords, unquote, that I've created. Some of them, most of them, I have no idea what the name of the chord is. I just know that it's up on the eighth fret and it only uses two of the strings out of the six that are on the guitar. Well, I have to relearn these tunes if I'm going to perform them in a manner similar to a demolition derby. What I mean by that is I get in the pickup truck, I play the first two or three notes of the chord, and it smashes into a wall because I can't remember anymore. I back the pickup truck up, and I try it again. And little by little, although the front end of the pickup truck is totally destroyed, I happen to move the wall from where I first encountered it to the completion of the tune, and I do remember all the chords. But it's a terrible way to have to relearn. I mean, how much nicer it would be to look at a score and go, oh, yeah, B7th. Yeah, that's right.
Now, have you always had a good ear?
Oh, yes.
Talk about, for people, because as you know, it's not a music audience per se who listens to this show. So to talk about what does it mean to have a good ear to you? And then talk about your own good ear.
Well, I think... You know, we move into an area where making decisions about what is in tune and what is not in tune become an important part of the what is a good ear criteria. I had a wonderful friend, I mean, still do, but I've moved to the country, and he was in Westchester, who was almost monotonalic, if such a word is available.
Sure.
But the song that we would sing together would be Linda. You know, when I go to sleep, I never count sheep. I count all the charms about Linda. And we would do it as a duet. And I loved it because his, and I asked him, I said, no, when I go to sleep, you hear sleep. And he would go, sleep. And I go, okay, that's close enough, right? I said, now, we're going to start with when I, and he'd go, when I. Okay, now we, then we're going to make the leap to sleep. All right, you ready? When I go to sleep. Well, what I discovered, Dan, is that he would make the move. He just didn't realize how high it was, and he never did. He didn't have an ear for hearing the intervals. So he could appreciate music, but it was, when I go to sleep, I never can achieve. I can only turn to Linda. They were in the right direction, but they didn't have the full commitment. So having an ear means, I think, grasping the intervals, understanding the intervals. And when you understand the intervals, then you can begin to play with them. Or in the first case of my experience, I'm maybe 7 years old, 8 years old. I'm standing up in the front seat of my dad's Oldsmobile. And mom's in the back seat, and I don't think it was we'd be coming around the mountain when she comes. It could be, I think maybe it was I'm looking over a four-leaf clover, which possibly your people who are listening to the show don't recognize, so I'll sing a little bit. I'm looking over a four-leaf clover that I overlooked before. And my dad broke into harmony. While we were singing, I was not prepared for it. He didn't tell me that he knew how to do it. He didn't say, watch out, here I go now. And when I heard that buzz in my ears, it was, I couldn't stop laughing. I mean, it was such a joy. And the moment that you hear harmony, then you begin to want to apply it. As a matter of fact, I got to make a personal confession. I don't mind Muzak in grocery stores. Why don't you mind music in grocery stores? Muzak in grocery stores. Because I either whistle or sing harmony and make up counterparts to them. So it's like somebody's playing me a basic track and I'm having a riff over the top of it. So I don't even hear what the original tune was so much as I hear the chord changes and where they might go. And I guess that's called having an ear and taking it a little bit too far.
Well, I think that's a better option than hearing it and just wanting to pull all your hair out because you hate it so much. or find a new grocery store, I guess. But I mean,
I got it. I would love to tell. Can I tell you a story about an upcoming album I'm working on? It starts, the story about the upcoming album starts in the probably early 80s. Peter, Paul, and Mary have been back together again for at least 4 years or so. And we are, because we're still quite popular in colleges and auditoriums that have towns that service several colleges, we are on tour with the Dave Brubeck Quartet. Now, I've always loved the Dave Brubeck Quartet, particularly his assembly conceptually of classical perspective and the improvisational skills to be able to play within them, which Desmond and he had in spades. They would sometimes, do rounds with each other, echo each other's lines, create this polytonality that just knocked my socks off. And so to be able to tour with the Brubeck Quartet was just such a thrill. And in the course of doing that, Peter, Paul, and Mary had learned a tune by Tom Glaser, a rewrite of St. Matthew's Passion. that he put lyrics to that were, because all men are brothers, wherever men may be, one union shall unite us forever, proud and free. It was a union, you know, he was a lefty and we love the tune. Well, because it was from St. Matthew's Passion, it was tailor-made for the Brubeck Quartet to improvise on. So we learned the tune together and put it on an album that eventually came out on Dave Brubeck's release. But in the context of this concert, we were going to do that one song together. Now, I don't know if you have felt the, how shall I say, the hesitation of a jazz musician to embrace fully the folk musician, but there is a tendency to denigrate the amount of chords that are used in folk music by a jazz player. So Paul Desmond drew the short straw, and he was on stage having to introduce three folkies who were going to sing this song with him. So his introduction ran something like this. We're going to bring some people up on stage now to do a tune with us. And I don't know whether we should call it Faz or Joke, which was the combination of jazz and folk. We all knew what he would have preferred to call it, given the invisible nature of the L in the word joke. But the fact was, Faz stayed with me until now, and that's the name of the new album.
Faz. I like it. It's catchy. I'm not going to forget it. Faz.
I'm releasing an album that has no Woody Guthrie tunes, but has a folk message is clothed in alternative chords.
So why another album? I mean, it's just because you can't do anything other than music. Is that a simple explanation? I mean, you got a lot more to say, right?
yes, and I'll stop the moment that I don't. Writing is a large part of the reason that I would go out on the road or make a CD. Though more and more, I think the records that I do put out reflect a collection of other people's artistry. I'll probably work with a half a dozen other people on this new album. But I have two or three originals. And as long as I'm writing, I'll be performing. And when I'm not, I'll just be admiring other people's work.
Yeah, I saw the picture I mentioned earlier. I was just browsing around the internet. I saw a picture of you from a couple weeks ago on stage with your guitar. I imagine you didn't do tons of playing with live audience during the pandemic, which is still ongoing, with your guitar. Well, how was that? Was it, I mean, were the nerves involved? I mean,
Oh, yeah. I had to back the pickup truck. I had to take the pickup truck back a couple of times to be able to remember the chords. But the interesting thing about music with lyrics is, and I might be telling secrets out of school now, and I'm going to be embarrassed when I run into somebody that was at that concert. If I got to a part in the song where my fingers just forgot the roadmap, the lyric holds people together. And, you know, they might have thought I was doing that section a cappella, or they might have thought, well, that's interesting. He just played tempo there on the guitar. Or that's an interesting inversion. I don't remember him recording it like that. So I have a rough time, you know, remembering all of those chords, but I did take that lesson away from the concert. It was a lot of fun. And of course, you know, after a year and a half of not being able to be together in a concert circumstance, albeit this one was challenging because it was outdoors. And so an audience doesn't react in a uniform way when they are so far apart from one another and the outdoors is commanding their attention more than the artist on stage.
What's our ideal setting for a solo concert? A few hundred seats inside? What's to describe your absolute ideal? What would the hall look like? What would the chairs look like? Everything.
I don't think there is one ideal, because you're really, at least in my world, the acceptance of the environment that you're in is the setting that is the most desirable. You know, if it's an audience of 50 people, in a small, not even, well, maybe a club or in a living room, there's going to be a lot more interactivity going on, or at least there should be in my book. A lot more involvement of the audience, a lot of give and take, a lot of ad-libbing. The larger that the hall gets, probably the more focused the performance of the music becomes, until, you know, when you get to the 20, 30,000 seat, you know, arenas or ballparks, you're basically just, you're almost doing it by rote. And unless, of course, you're fortunate enough to have bandmates with whom you can enjoy that special moment. But then at that point, the, you know, the 5,000 to 30,000 people just become observers, pretty much. Though the exception to that is Peter Yarrow of the trio, who could get anybody to sing. I mean, large numbers of people would all be singing with Peter, because he had brought that talent with him from Cornell, where he went to school, and was featured in a program that I think he possibly had self-named Romp and Stomp, which was a bringing of folk music to the college campuses back when he was part of the college campus.
So when you mentioned Peter Yarrow, this is Peter of Peter, Paul, and Mary, and you look at him, you look at you, and you two are still good friends, and you play together occasionally, I gather. You clearly you have a lot of respect for him. Go a little deeper when you say, well, he could get them to do that. What, I mean, that you can't, or you don't like to, or what's, I mean, to put it crudely, what's the difference?
I think that our two roads of expression, Peter's road and my road, have been drawn towards each other over a period of time since we've known each other. And I certainly have learned a great deal about group singing from him. But, you know, he was my mentor. So in a sense, he is the master of that. And I think Peter has that capacity to be professorial, which some people, you know, respond to obediently when they're told to sing some part. He's also childish and engaging and totally silly. Like he'll start off singing Puff the Magic Dragon, and people can't help themselves. They'll start singing with him, and he'll stop right in the middle of the first verse, put his hands on his hip, and said, "Who told you could sing along with me?" And everyone knows that he's kidding. I mean, it is that combination of all of those little quirky things that makes Peter who he is, that make an evening with him and singing along with him so special.
You and I were chatting a little ways back, and the term protest music came up, and I wonder what it is to you. What is protest music? I mean, isn't all music that you've been involved with, in a sense, protest music, or at least music that makes a statement that goes beyond the banal, beyond the cliches?
I remember Mary defining protest in its Latin root, saying pro means for and test is testimony. So it was a positive testimony, thinking that that's the guideline for protest music, that it speaks to that which could be or that which should be. And to a large extent, I follow that whether I'm proclaiming, you know, a spiritual rebirth for someone, or the rediscovery of love in their lives, and or perhaps even equating that with a larger love that has created this entire universe and our community of life. At the same time, there is a, you know, an awareness that some things are rotten in Denmark, as they say. So there have been
all goes back to Shakespeare, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And there are a couple of songs that I've created, which most pointedly, refer to that. And yet, there, you know, once you're convinced that the root of all of us living creatures is love, then you're always looking for the redemptive angle, the redemptive solution to the differences that we have. And I'm afraid that I am guilty of not being able to refuse that perspective. And most of the songs that I create have created over the past 70 years, 60 years, have always had that remedial or redemptive bent to them. And yet, I would have to agree with you that, yeah, they are protest songs because they are, in a sense, trying to take us from perhaps where we've complacently arrived to a more invigorating, exciting, and hopeful future.
You mentioned the political divide earlier, far left, far right. I imagine you're not on either extreme, but certainly you've been observing American politics alongside American music for your entire life. We're at a tough time here, and I know it's something that you're aware we talk about a lot on this show, and I always maybe naively talk to people about the unifying power of music, and maybe it sounds naive to some people and maybe silly, but it's all I can say.
That's so sweet. And naive is the word that I've used to describe my perspective, particularly on a song that's now has its own website called Revolution One by One, because it was written shortly after 9/11. And, you know, it, in the face of that kind of evil incarnate, whether no matter which side of the tragedy you are, whether you're, you know, related to a victim or whether you are someone whose home has been destroyed in a foreign war and families have been killed and now you have nothing left to live for, the fact that there is no earthly resolution, no political answer for these divisions, beg the question then, well, since all of humanity yearns for resolution, where can we find an answer? And I recognized at some point that, as naive as it might be, this is a one-by-one challenge. That's why the lyric says, I'm going to start a revolution. I'm going to take it to the street. I'm going to smile at every solitary person that I meet. I'm going to wave at total strangers, no matter where they're from. I'm going to start a revolution, and I'm going to win it one by one. And my favorite part of the song is a bridge that happens a little later that says, but we're a raggle-taggle army. We got no uniform or guns, but we've been called by coincidence. So maybe we're the ones to take this revolution to the street, smile at every solitary person that we meet, wave at total strangers, no matter where they're from. We're going to start a revolution and we're going to win it one by one. I think that's how we're going to get out of this, is by giving each other the respect and admiration for stepping out on a unique and most personal level to make the other person comfortable. Whether that's a crinkle behind a mask that you're wearing at the grocery store when you almost run into their cart of groceries, or whether that's allowing somebody to pull out into traffic ahead of you, or whether that's opening a door for somebody coming in or coming out of the post office. I think that therein lies the victory, with each of us taking that role unto ourselves and making the world a better place.
The songs you're doing now, I don't know what you like to do. You like to take a walk out in, I don't know where in Maine you are. You like to walk around the wilderness there up in Maine and think of words. Did you sit with a guitar? I mean, what are you going to do when we get off this? And what's your schedule? What's your habits?
Well, thank you, Daniel, for the encouragement to go do that. I am a cathartic writer. That is to say, I do respond to those thoughts, those challenges or concepts that have come up in my life, and relate them personally to how I think they should be dealt with. And every once in a while, I will come across a riddle that I haven't solved. And I will write a verse and then back the pickup truck again and come back to it on another day and try to write a verse. For instance, right now I'm in a quandary. I know this song is going to end up on the Faz album, and I love the chording for it. Here, I'll play a little bit for you. I'll play the one verse that I have. Let's see. The fun police. Do you have a license for that smile? What makes you think that you have got the right to bring that light into this darkness? We are the fun police. Now, the quandary here is the statement I'm making is that this absurd group of people are going around diminishing the joy. Who are they? Where do they come from? Why do they do that? And should we obey them? And I don't know if I'm going to be able to pull that all together in two or three more verses and a bridge. But therein lies the fun and the challenge of responding to the grimness that we see around us and saying it doesn't have to be that way.
So when can we look for the album?
Probably mid-November, you know, if all goes well. I have about 8 or 9 tunes towards it. And Lord willing, the creek don't rise and the fun police go back into hiding, I should have something by mid-November.
Well, we'll look for it. Noel Paul Stuckey, I feel like your disposition is very youthful in a way. You think it's because of music, because of the optimism you naturally have in you, or just the sort of a lightness you have about you?
Well, thank you. I was privileged to be raised as an only child by two very loving parents. One, a very creative mechanical engineer who could fix anything with baling wire and scotch tape, and a mother who was artistic and caring to her community. So, you know, between those two pillars in my life, how could I possibly turn out resentfully? You know, I am just blown away. And which brings up another question, and that is one of entitlement. You know, we live in an era where the advantages of some seem to overwhelm the disadvantages of others. And I think we need to begin to recognize that the advantages of some are sometimes even as esoteric as having two parents. And that we have to be sensitive to the fact that many people are not even given that as a starting point. And so we have to find means to equalize their opportunity by affording them the luxury of believing in them in the way that perhaps their absent parents could not. And that, to me, is, that's the big challenge we're facing.
And maybe you'll be part of the route to show us out of that. And I guess we'll find out. We'll find out mid-November. We'll find out as we listen to you, as we reflect on the music and the words, and we give a wink and a nod behind our mask at the grocery store, and who knows what good that'll do. And maybe when I'm in the store, I'll try to do some harmonizing myself, take a page out of your book, sir.
Oh, that's wonderful, Dan. Thank you for your encouragement. I really enjoyed our conversation today. Bless you, man.
You've been listening to Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk. The original theme music is by Ronald Barkham. The content coordinator is Nathaniel Mosse, and Doug Christian is executive producer. We invite you to subscribe and leave a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. You can support us at patreon.com/talkingbeats. That's patreon.com/talkingbeats. And be sure to check us out on social media. We'll see you next time on Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk.